Session number 30109.
Hey, Candice, real one. Eddie, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
She was born on Merseyside, Birkenhead, 1952.
And what about your family background?
I come from a normal sort of family background, local people. My father used to work for Stork Margarine on Merseyside. My mum was a mummers in those days. I'm the eldest of three. I've got a younger brother and sister. And, yeah, I just went through a normal local education.
What about joining the services? When did that come about?
Actually, it's probably a late joiner, really, in that respect. I didn't actually join the Royal Marines until I was age 21. I'd thought about it possibly earlier at school, not quite sure, didn't go to uni, but got a job. I was working for the Inland Revenue, of all people. And a mate of mine who I knew from high school had actually gone away, joined, came back, totally changed, some sort of 12 months later, and said, well, you just got to give it a go, and that's what I did.
How did you go about joining? What was it?
It's quite amusing, actually. In those days, I was very much into bike racing. I was a fairly well-known cyclist in the Merseyside area. And when I went to the careers office, the warrant officer that interviewed me kept saying, I know your name from somewhere. It's not a common one, but I know your name from somewhere. Why do I know you? You know, I sort of said, well, I can't think, but unless you read the sports pages, maybe, you might have said, that's a really strong one. Sport in the corn, you'll do well on that. And he sort of half convinced me if I needed convincing to actually join the Marines. And needless to say, I never touched a bike since.
So there was no element of choosing anything else. It was going to be the Royal Marines, was it?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think really because Steve Cox, my friend, who went on to be a brigadier in the corps as well, an extremely good friend from high school. Yeah, his sort of summation of what was happening was probably enough to give me the, I've got to get out of this dreary office, I want to get out and do something, you know, be active in my life. And so I never considered anything else. And of course my background is from my grandfather through my great-great-grandfather is very much Royal Navy.
And where did you join? When?
When? 30th of April 1973 at Deal.
Can you tell me a little bit about the pattern of the early training you had when you were at Deal, what you did?
Look, it was quite interesting. And I say, being the age I was when I joined, there was sort of a mixture. In those days, there were sort of at least three or four guys who were probably a little bit older. They possibly had reservist background or territorial army. And a bunch of guys probably younger than me, you know, 18, 19-year-olds. It was a recruit troop rather than a junior troop. And I didn't find it that much of a shock. We did a sort of first 4 weeks, I think, at Livingston before we moved. A Deal before we moved to Livingston, and that was a new pattern of the way they were doing training. And those first 4 weeks at Deal, when we were marching up and down, was okay. It was a little bit different than some of that sort of drills, the basics, but some of the basic field living and camping out in inverted commas overnight sort of thing, found it fairly straightforward. I'd been in the scouts when I was younger, and it was just outdoors. It was good fun. It was actually quite enjoyable looking back on it.
Did everybody take to it, or was one or two?
No, I think in the nature of the way the process went, you know, the recruiting process, you've got to weed out one or two of the individuals who are patent knocking over there, including one guy about 3 hours into it who collapsed on the beach on the first run we did. It turned out he had a condition that they didn't know about, and nor did he, so that was quite quickly dealt with, obviously. A couple of the other guys struggled, and some guys, yeah, with the whole mixture, some people turned up, and obviously I was fit for my cycling and stuff, and other guys who played various sports. There were some of the guys you looked at and went, God, you're going to struggle. But given the due, they stuck it out, and I did better than some of the others in many cases.
After there, what was the move to? Was it to Livingston from Deal?
Yes, we moved. As I say, after about the first 4 weeks at Deal, we moved on to Livingston by train on Sunday, as the military always did in those days. Got to this new awe-inspiring place called Livingston Commando Training Centre, Royal Marines. Much more modern than Deal, obviously, in terms of structure and infrastructure. And that was a bit of a start of an eye-opener, I think, though. And one of our training corporals only joined us at that point. He'd just come back from Ireland, and he was a bit of a hard bloke, if you like, and he was straight into it. I think they'd gone through the honeymoon period, if you like, making concessions for certain things. Now you were starting to be formed into a body of men that would work as a troop, and really all the way through training right to the culmination of the thrust of it, I think, really is quite genuinely is the training team to make you lot bind together as a troop and sections within that troop, and against the trains you, if nobody else, have them as the enemy if you want, and that you work together and work against. And I think that's probably still persists this day. Said that, guys that were on my train team become my best of friends after we'd finished and completed. You know, there's no lasting animosity. It's just a method of binding that core, esprit de corps together.
Does the Marines Corps differ in that sense from other elements of the services in how they, what they want from a recruit?
Yes, look, I think they really do, and I've learned that over the full course of my career, having had the opportunity to serve on a number of occasions with the Army in exchange and see the product of their basic training coming into the system. Royal Marines, I think you probably describe as being a thinking man soldier. That's the sort of ethos that we have. It's not much point of blindly following orders or take the American model maybe and just drum it all out of them and put this almost robotic individual out there. It's very much a question of encouraging you to question, not because the sergeant says do or whatever, but if you see, I mean, if you're under fire, for example, if you can see where the enemy is firing at you, it's not, well, I won't tell anyone because he'll tell me what to do in a minute. You need to actually be taking part in that operation and inform yourself and necessarily talk them onto the target so you can do it. No, it's good.
So what pattern does the form does the training take when you're at the commando centre?
6 months basic training. I believe it's not still the longest basic infantry training you can get in this country, and certainly for the world in that sense, because most of the ones don't do that long. Normally, over that 36 weeks, it's split down to fairly what they used to call basic and basic coming and advanced coming. Basic training is really that would teach you all the skills you require to be a basic infantryman, as probably many of the line regiments in the Army and so on and so forth do. So you march, you look after yourself, you live in the field, you can fire a rifle, you've got a knowledge of a few other bits and pieces, your tactics are being brought on. Advanced company, as far as the Corps goes, is when you start to the commando training, the bit that's going to differentiate you from the from hopefully the rest if you want to be elitist about it. Commando training itself actually starts to introduce a lot more in terms of additional weaponry and ability and skills with those, more advanced tactics, more advanced ability to live for long periods in the field. And a thread all the way through, of course, has been the physical fitness, the physical elements of it. And they sort of like to take that to the next stage beyond, because, of course, so most people are aware, you know, we don't have armoured personnel carriers that drift around or even really trucks on Land Rovers. 95% of the time, the delivery method of the brigade into the field would be by a landing craft or helicopter, and once you're there, you're on your feet and you've got your pack and away you go. And if it's northern Norway, well, you ski, you know, but there's no one going to take you along the route.
And that training, again, sadly, what does the form take? What do you do to increase endurance and physical fitness? Are there any specific things that the Marines do?
I think, yeah. I mean, the physical strengthening is obviously one very strong part of it. I think there's a fair degree of mental strengthening goes on in the nature of when you're not actually in the field, you're not actually doing something tactile and physical in the field, whether it be weapons or purely an exercise in which you're, you know, long-range patrolling or stuff like this, then the other side of it would be this, as I say, this sort of this mental sort of stiffening, and actually they seem to brief you on larger resistance to interrogation, for example, I mean, because of the nature of the game, you're possibly falling in that environment, so there's a lot more goes there. And then they've got specific tests at the back end of it that you will pass, because if you don't, you don't get there. So after the 6 months, you could be in the final month or so and still fail. So you do your combined Tarzan assault course. Tarzan course is an agility course, basically. It's about 30 foot up in the trees around Limston. Requires you to cross between these trees in a wide variety of ways. Obviously, you're carrying your fighting ordinary rifle with you as well. Some leaps of faith across gaps and swinging to nets and so on and so forth. They have the endurance course itself. It's about 4 miles on Woodbury Common, which is nearby. That involves there's a pool that one goes through, which is cold even in the middle of winter. It is freezing cold, and you get yourself across, and obviously you're absolutely saturated, and you're only at the start of this run over rough terrain. Various tunnels you have to scramble through and bits of underground. The infamous water tunnel, which is it's probably about 2 metres long, and you work as a team of three. You have to up to that point, because one stands at either end of this totally submerged tunnel, and if you're the victim, if you're one that's going through at the time, one helps push you and the other one's trying to grab you because you couldn't move through it, but you're totally submerged in black water. It's a test of faith, basically. And that completes with more runs, more tunnels and everything else. All run then all the way back down to them, so it's about a further 3 miles. Once back down there, you get a couple of minutes just to prepare the rifle, and then there's a target shoot at the end of it, which gives you time.
Does that whole process help build a teamwork? Do you become a squad? Do you become a Marine in that?
Very much so. The whole thrust of it is, they're always saying it's true. Your squad mates are guys that you will know not just the rest of your career, but for time after. I can quote the serial numbers of guys immediately around me. It's just sort of thing you know, that sort of thing.
And I take it at this stage you were thoroughly enjoying the experience, or were you apprehensive with it, or was it a real task?
Well, I got through the halfway mark where you can buy yourself out for £20, basically no questions asked. A couple of surprises actually left us then, but that's by the by. And having then committed to carry on, I must admit I got to probably about 4 weeks or so from the end, and there's just this question in my mind, and I phoned my father up in Merseyside, and you know, he'd been in the military in the past and the war and things, and just said, "Dad, I'm just not too sure, am I doing the right thing?" And all he said to me, he said, "I'm not going to tell you what to do. I've never told you what to do." He said, just quite simply, he said, "You do what you feel your best." He said, "And if you walk away from it," he said, "there's no one going to tell you did wrong." And that's the best thing.
So what was the decision at that time for you?
The decision was I stayed, and that wasn't through any fear of failure. It was a rationalisation. It was just nice to know other people cared. And, well, you know, without being big-headed, culminated in being the King's Pageman in my squad as well.
What happens at the end? Is there a passing out parade?
Yes. Oh, yes, very much so.
And at that stage, are you allowed to specialise, or do you have to choose a specialism, or is that not part of it, or are you just allocated to where you would go once you've passed out?
Yeah, I'll see what you mean. You go through a process in the final few weeks before the passing out parade, the King Squad. Your King Squad, the final week of your training, and it's a big honour to do that, and everyone gets a lot out of it. Big passing out play, big digital display, all your fakes come and watch it, which is great. And probably just prior to that final week, you do what they call PSO interviews, personnel officers, basically human resources, I suppose, in civilian terms. And they sort of seem to want to discuss with you what you might want to do and where you might want to go. And that could possibly be in the future, but just like a career path sort of idea for you. I was one of many that conned into going to be a radio operator. It was strange, but it was quite funny really, because even when I joined, I had this sort of idea, seeing all the glossy bits of being in the aviation, the core part, might be quite interesting. And he persuaded me that, of course, well, as I already knew, I'd have to wait some time for rank to come along to do that, which I was quite happy to do, but convinced me in the meantime that maybe being a radio operator and being a reconnaissance pilot was a good idea. I got cons. I mean, it didn't harm, but it gave me a different path.
So did you have to go and do specialised training?
Yes, I did. When we actually passed out, in those days, most people went straight away to a commander unit for a couple of years. You didn't really get to do anything too specialised till then. In my case, the radio ops course was right at the end of our training. So I was still at Limpston for about another 4, maybe 5 weeks to the radio ops course. And then I went off to join 40 Commander, which is my unit.
Run me through what that kind of radio course was like. What you know, what the equipment that you would be using at that time, where you carried it, you know, that
heavy. Heavy. but yeah, basically the Larkspur series of radios. So anything from A40 through A41, and teaching the C42. Radio op wasn't actually a specialisation in terms of what we call an SQ, where you're eventually going to be a signaller and so on and so forth. Radio op was what they call an AGQOL, but they had that time, a shortage of signallers, and they wanted to make up people with the extra. So that's what we did. It was a good course. It was very practical. And to be honest, it made me learn an awful lot about the communication aspects, and therefore, in all the other aspects of my career, communication was never a problem.
Does that involve, obviously, learning radio procedure?
Yes.
And how the equipment functions?
Yeah, basically. I mean, it was fairly archaic equipment, even by modern standards. But, so, you know, you had to tune the radio. It wasn't all preset channels and stuff like that. in terms of the voice procedure, yeah, I mean, obviously you had to be pretty good at the radio procedures and the various codes that were in use in those days as well, and Slidex and Backco and stuff like that. So you're working, well, I ended up as Bravo Company Commander Signaller, or radio op, for probably a good year when I first got to 40. And that was good. He was an SBS officer and extremely good in the field, but he wanted his radio man with him all the time and had plenty of messages for controlling his troops, so it was good.
So your posting was to 40 Commander?
40 Commander, yeah.
Where were they at the time?
They were in Seaton Barracks in Plymouth, so this was... It was nice. I'd, you know, being a lad from the northwest, I suddenly got used to the Exeter area. Now we're moving a bit further south into Devon, and the barracks was quite a good barracks in those days. It was on top of the hill just outside of Plymouth there, and it was actually quite a large. In fact, it's a commercial park, I think, these days or something.
And what were your duties while you were in the barracks? Was there anything specific?
Oh, look, as a Marine, yeah, predominantly, obviously, as the radio, maybe part of the signals troop, in theory, but then you go into the detachment, to the rifle company you're attached to. So day-to-day in barracks would be a question of between working with a SIGS troop and starting with them, but if the company was doing anything deployed in the field and required their radio people with them, and then obviously we'd go off with them. So there's a balance between the two, that guard duty. And in those days, volleyball. Signal Street was always very good at volleyball. And so every spare minute of the day when you weren't actually doing something more practical, we had a net just right outside the room, and the volleyball would be grabbed and we'd play volleyball. It was pretty late. It was good to arrive in a unit in those days. The age I was, the guys had not long come back from being in the Far Eastern Brigades. A lot of old hands there. My age sort of threw them a little bit because they kept forgetting I wasn't like this 18-year-old guy who'd just arrived the same week, and they saw him as new, whereas they saw me as older, and consequently I didn't really ever get treated as if I was some new boy, you know.
What was your first deployment away from Plymouth?
So that was late 73, went there. 74, yeah. Cyprus, the emergency.
What did that involve for the commander?
Basically, the unit was... we were actually the spearhead unit in UK at the time, and got almost to the end of the spearhead serving time. Nothing had happened in Northern Ireland, which everyone potentially anticipated us going to, and of course out of the blue when the Turks invaded Cyprus, it was get the spearhead battalion going. We actually were sent as a unit to Akrotiri, RAF Akrotiri in Cyprus, and the main aim was to basically defend the sovereign base area of Akrotiri and assist where we could, and that was the initial thing. Always remember briefing when we arrived after about 7 hours on a Britannia aircraft, RAF Britannia aircraft, with a sticky seats and funny seating arrangements and no rifle in your hand. We had to put them all in the hold, even though we were getting out potentially to a war zone. And we jumped out and they gathered us all in this hangar. This brigade army intelligence major had this chalkboard with a pretty crude outline of Cyprus drawn on it, and there's a big arrow off to the north and another one sort of sweeping around to the southeast side of the island, and he said, right, gentlemen, you're here. Yesterday 63,000 men in armour of the Turkish army landed up here to the north. Force Bravo's out here about the same size and we don't know where they're going. Any questions? And there was a three badge that cut me. I'm really a real old bloke, you know, been in the scene and done everything. No one else could ask questions, so he stuck his hand up. And this major sort of, he could see, and oh no, someone's got a question. And he said, "Sir, when are we going to get our guns in case these guys come ashore?" And it was a sudden realisation. I think the panic. Oh, well, shit, yeah, these guys are all stood here ready to do things, but they haven't got any weapons with them.
So was your job to protect the sovereign?
Yeah, effectively it was a lot. We put out a lot of vehicle checkpoints around all the periphery of the sovereign base area. We actually deployed some people further along to Episcopi, where there's a radio master. I think it's actually a BBC one as well down there. And there was a bit of concern about that, so there's deployed some there. But predominantly, yeah, to check this rather almost imaginary border between the SBA and National Cyprus, and that made life very difficult because guys obviously find well, there's no real border as such. There's this stone here and that tree there, and finding a way around was a bit hard. But set up enough posts around the area that one could control the likelihood of anything happening. The Turks never got that far, and in reality, we ended up actually looking after more the Turkish Cypriots who lived in that part of the island, the southern part, who were being turned against slightly by, I think, the Greek Cypriots who lived in the area, and they sort of became refugees and came into what was a sports stadium, and there's some it was called Happy Valley, and it's became known as, and we sort of housed a lot of them there. It's a lot of refugee stuff, really, more than anything else.
What was the state of the refugees at the time?
Pretty confused. I mean, for me, it was, you know, a bit of an eye-opener, exposed to somewhere. I haven't been overseas before, but not overseas like somewhere like that, and sort of seen ordinary people. The one that struck me is overly wealthy people. You know, they were ordinary people, farming people more than anything else. I think they're pretty distraught and upset, and they were leaving farms and things that obviously they'd been there on for a long time. The future was pretty uncertain. I think there were some elements, though. I know certainly some of the guys got involved and had to sort of police this refugee camp fairly strongly because of some agitators amongst them. You know, ones that wished to see the Turkish army sweep all the way down here and rescue them, so to speak, and dispose of the Greeks and the Brits while they're at it. You know, it was a very interesting time, very interesting.
Were there any incidents that occurred that spring to mind while you were there?
The main one I would know about, I wasn't involved in directly, but certainly anyone who's in 40 will probably know of it, which was within probably a couple of hours of that briefing in the hangar I spoke of. We're in a place called French Camp, which became known as the Dust Bowl because there was nothing there but dust blowing around. And they sent out a recce troop patrol. They needed to get one up fairly quickly. And these guys zotted off on the Land Rovers. And I said the border was very difficult anyway to define. They ended up on this small patrol, sort of came around the corner of this wadi and were almost surrounded by 30-odd Greek Cypriot, I think it's called Greek National Guard, if I remember rightly. And these guys were extremely well armed with lots of automatic weapons. Our boys were just sort of caught cold. And they were proceeded then to be berated by this their officer. Their officer actually was a Greek army officer. He was in a full Greek uniform, so he wasn't Cypriot at all. And was telling them fairly good English that they basically strayed somewhere they shouldn't be and just hand over all the guns and give up, basically, and all the rest of it. And a little argument ensued, as you can imagine, a little bit about the debate about who was wrong and who was right. And guy I do know had the GPMG in his hand at the time, and really the last thing he wanted to do was start a firefight because they were outgunned. But he managed, I don't know how he did it, he got one round out of the GPMG rather than the burst, which shot the Greek officer through the bum, who promptly fell to the ground bleeding like a stuck pig and squealing, and all the other people ran away, thank God. You know, it was all, I wouldn't say it was hushed up, but it was certainly brushed over what could have been a major diplomatic incident, because it was never really established who was in which part. Were they in Cyprus or were they in the SBA? But came out good.
Were they seen as a threat, the National Guard at all?
They were thugs. Most of the Greek National Guard that we ever came across, we cleared the RAF housing in Limassol a short while later, which is outside of the SBA and just along the coast. The RAF decided they were evacuating all the civilian personnel and families and so on and so forth, and non-essential RAF personnel. And one of the tasks came for us as companies, it sort of took it in turn from the unit, to go across to Limassol, help evacuate the families, help empty the married quarters, because they basically decided, well, if we were going to move, they were going to take all the military furniture and everything else that was in the homes, load them back to trucks and things, and no one was going to get that, so to speak, otherwise it'd been looted. And the first company, Alpha Company, had been over and done it, and they went armed, I'm almost certain, when they went over there. And apparently there's a big brouhaha about that, because it was seen as Greek Cyprus, if you want, allowing us to go and do that, but not walk around with guns, because we weren't there to enforce anything, so to speak. We were just furniture removers, I suppose. So by the time I went with my company, there were no weapons at all, and you weren't allowed to carry, well, I think there were a couple of pickles on the back of the truck, was about the best we could get away with. And one of our guys actually got accosted by one of the GNG while we were doing the work. It was sort of spread out while we were working. Got accosted by the GNG because he had a knife, as well as a sheath knife. And there was a fair bit of pushing and shoving starting to go on, and some of the boys got involved, and sort of Major had to jump in and sort of like, oh, you've got to leave it, and you want to have a go at this bloke, and he's got no respect for you. And they were unshaven, you know, smoking fags all the time, bimbling around with sunglasses on, sort of people that they didn't impress at all. They were quite thuggish the way they were going about their work. Excuse me.
But there was no potential threat really to the
I don't territory. I don't think there was any real threat, no. No.
How long were you deployed to Cyprus?
I'm going to stress to remember now. It'd probably be a couple of months. And I know it was one of those funny deployments that they decided after about 3 or 4 weeks of doing this that the whole thing died a death. Let's get people home. Bravo Company, as I said, was attached to. We got on the plane and actually got back to UK. And I know Charlie Company got on the plane, they wound its engines up and then shut them down again and told them to get off. And we had the arduous flight all the way back home again, got off the plane, straight down to Plymouth, straight into barracks about 2 o'clock in the morning to be told, 8 o'clock in the morning, go and leave, which is exactly what we did. So I made issue rail warrants, so I jumped on the train, got all the way back up to Merseyside. So hi Dad, I'm home. He said, I'm off to work. I said, okay, I'll catch you this evening. About 2 hours later, there was a knock on the front door. I was trying to sleep, obviously, I've been travelling, and it's a very good friend of mine, actually, from school, who's now a police officer. He said, ah, you're here, he says, you've been recalled. No, go away, stupid, that was weeks ago. No, you've been recalled again, trust me. So I phoned Seaton Barracks, guard room. The duty senior answered, I mean, not the corporal in charge of the guard, the duty senior. Yes, Candlish, got you, Bravo Company, Liverpool, train leaves Lime Street at whatever time, be on it, bye, bang. So, of course, by that time, I had to go out and get the local, the national papers, and, of course, it was across the, it happened overnight. You get back there. Out of the reverse journey and rocked up back out to Cyprus and climbed off the plane with our guns this time. The RAF changed their minds, but let's carry our weapons with us in the aircraft. Straight off the plane, almost expecting to be fighting. We'd had a blood and guts departure speech from Seaton, one of them, unfair, probably I think it was the Major General Commander of Forces at the time, who said, you know, the Corps had a proud history and everything else, and he had a lot of respect for all the guys, and look, it's you know, it's just pretty bloody serious, but we know you do the right job, come what the cost might be. And there was a little bit of apprehension. We seriously got the impression we might have to fight ourselves off the airport this time around, because we were starved of any other sort of news. As it was, we got off the plane and went back to the same locations we'd been beforehand and spent another sort of 4 weeks in the sun.
What had triggered the redeployment?
There'd been, during the course of all this, of course, the Famagusta end of the island, the other, the Achilles on base area, up that end, 4-1 commando was potentially going in there, and the Gurkhas had gone in there. And I think probably because the island is so much narrower up that northeast corner, the Turks had expanded there. Before they got this green line business, they were still expanding. And in fact, the Gurkhas came very close to having a full-on contact with them and Turkish soldiers. So they got quite iffy up there, and I think there were enough threatening noises in the politics of all that the Turks were not really going to stop where they were. Why would they? They might as well carry on and take the whole lot.
But that didn't develop while you were there at all.
No, the Green Line was sort of basically being established. This sort of at the back end of our time, it was quite clear there was some sort of ceasefire peace agreement going to take place. And obviously, as you know, the island still is divided, I believe, but certainly it was divided for many years. And the UN policed it, and they sort of knew they'd reached that stage. In fact, the next sort of buzz going around was that we were going to be left there for a while and convert to UN troops and help police the thing. As it was, we didn't. We came back to UK and 4-1 Commander actually ended up in that job.